You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluff Daily Nonpareil for April 30th. I'm Renata Walther from Drake University. Here's our first story. The first story is titled Minden Recovering from Tornado Hit. It was written by Andrew Smith from the Council Bluffs Nonpareil. At the start of the article, there is a photo taken in Minden of some damage left by the tornado. The story starts, the tornadoes left destruction in their path Friday, leaving Pottawatomie County in a state of emergency and devastating the community of Minden. Access to Minden remained largely closed to non-residents Monday, and about half the community was without shelter Friday. The entire city was without power and natural gas. A curfew between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. was put into effect in the community. Governor Kim Reynolds immediately issued a disaster proclamation, and Minden declared its own state of emergency. Relief and cleanup efforts have since begun, although scattered thunderstorms are possible later this week, with the National Weather Service office in Valley, Nebraska, saying Monday the threat of severe storms was uncertain. One Minden resident died as a result of injuries sustained in the storm. It was the only known fatality in the region. A handful of other injuries have been reported to Pottawatomie County officials, but they were not life-threatening. One emergency responder was treated for injuries at a hospital and released. It's heartbreaking to see these people who have lost houses, cars, essentially their life, until they have to rebuild it. Jeff Tulin, chief deputy of the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office, said at a late Friday briefing. Doug Reed, director of the Pottawatomie County Emergency Management Agency, estimated that 180 houses in the community had been impacted, with about 40% of them destroyed. Roads into Minden were blocked by Pottawatomie County deputies, limiting entrance to their first responders, residents, and cleanup crews. By the time the nonpareil arrived on the scene Friday night, on Saturday, Minden Fire and Rescue asked that volunteers stay away until things were more secure and safe. A news media tour was provided on Monday. After the storm Friday, residents were asked to evacuate after the disaster due to safety concerns. A yellow school bus was seen by the nonpareil entering the town to shuttle residents to a safe location. A deputy cited the risk of the area having no power, water, or gas. Outside the town, friends and family parked their cars and called their loved ones. After waiting for over 90 minutes outside the barriers, Council Bluffs residents Tina and Victor Dominguez gave up trying to pick up Tina's sister, who lives in Minden. They had a tree through their roof and windows shattered, Tina said. They did go to the basement, though, she said. I'm good. I got my wine. I'm good. After a phone call, the Dominguez told the nonpareil that their relative wasn't evacuating her home despite pleas from law enforcement officers. She also believed her car to be totaled. The Red Cross established two shelters in the county that were not needed as displaced residents were able to arrange overnight accommodations, according to Pottawatomie County Emergency Management. A Salvation Army Omaha Disaster Relief Team brought 100 meals Sunday to recovery workers, volunteers, and first responders in Minden. The group will continue this multi-community disaster relief operation for as long as it is needed, officials said. On Friday night, at the Minden United Church of Christ, which survived the storm and has become a community hub of help and support, there were plans to take four-wheel drive vehicles out to devastated parts of town to bring meals to those who need them, Pastor Eric Beale said. A lot of people are just kind of in shock, Beale said. It's all overwhelming now. Tammy Favich, who stores equipment on the west edge of town, said she kind of breathed a sigh of relief after the first round of tornadoes moved through Omaha. Then, she recalled, the storm hit Minden dead on. Todd Lehan, lifelong resident of the town, said he took shelter in a windowless basement. It sounded like a vacuum cleaner on top of our house, Lehan recalled. Reed credited early warnings from the Weather Service, preparedness on the part of emergency responders, and the attentiveness of residents with keeping the human toll low. We're not surprised, he said. We're thankful. Under blue skies on Saturday morning, Tori Crozier took stock of the farm she shares with her husband, Jared, and their five children, about a mile south of Minden. The large shed that housed a number of vehicles and Jared's man cave was destroyed. The greenhouse where Crozier had been raising plants she hoped to sell was damaged. The foundation of the family's home was tilted, the north wall detached. We don't know if the house is salvageable, Tori Crozier said. I'm assuming not. Still, three dozen volunteers using a fleet of heavy equipment already was swarming the farm to help clean up the wreckage. Crozier was thankful that both her family and most of her livestock were okay. Her family was in the basement when the storm hit. They felt pressure in their heads and their ears popped. The pressure left her with headache. As soon as the storm passed, friends, family, and neighbors began arriving. They couldn't do much Friday night, but they started again right away Saturday. The family lost about half their chickens, but the cows, horses, and goats were fine. A calf, picked up by the storm and flung into a fence, was injured but was expected to survive. That was a scary thing, because I didn't want any of them to die, she said. Crozier said she probably will stay with her sister for now, but area residents already had begun offering up campers and homes on Facebook as options for displaced residents. That's the great part about a small town, is you can offer that and trust people, she said. Non-Prelli managing editor Scott Stewart contributed to this report, which also contains materials from the Associated Press and the Omaha World Herald. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to the next one. This next story is titled Relief Efforts Aim to Assist Tornado Victims in Southwest Iowa, written by Scott Stewart from the Council Bluffs Non-Prelli. Following Friday's devastation in Minden and elsewhere in southwest Iowa, along with the greater Omaha Council Bluffs metropolitan area, cleanup and recovery are well underway. The Red Cross had been mobilizing disaster volunteers who are distributing relief supplies and meal kits over the days ahead, according to a news release. Red Cross volunteers continue to assess the residential damage in affected communities, the release states. Residents affected by the storm could receive assistance by calling 1-800-RED-CROSS. For those wanting to support disaster survivors, Pottawatomie County Emergency Management is encouraging monetary donations, which allows responders to provide exactly what's needed to those seeking assistance. Donations can be made to the Southwest Iowa Emergency Relief Fund to support areas impacted throughout the region at givewesterniowa.org. A special fund dedicated to the community of Minden is in the process of being created. Donations to the fund will support Iowa nonprofit partners, communities, disaster relief organizations, and public health organizations who are on the front line of disaster relief efforts, according to the Community Foundation for Western Iowa. Share Iowa, an initiative of the foundation, offers a resource to access information on how you can assist our communities through relief efforts. Share Iowa will update its resource website as information is submitted at sharegoodiowa.org-tornado. Relief items for the Minden and East Pottawatomie communities were being collected at the Neola Erie Community Center. Relief items for the Crescent community were being collected at the Crescent Fire Barn. The United Way of the Midlands also has set up the Nebraska and Iowa Tornado Relief Fund to help those with displaced families and destroyed homes. Donate to the fund by visiting unitedwaymidlands.org-tornado or relief. Texting Tornado 24 to 41444 or calling 402-522-7962. The United Way says 100% of the donations will be directed to nonprofit programs meeting people's needs for emergency shelter and essential needs, such as food and clothing, according to a news release. That's the end of that story. Let's move on to the next one. Our next story is titled Tornado Leaves Damage Along 35th Street, written by Andrew Smith from the Council Bluffs Non-Prelli. Pictured at the start of the article is a woman with tornado damage in the background. While largely unscathed on the east end, northwestern Council Bluffs saw a funnel from Epley Airfield in Omaha jump through some of its western neighborhoods Friday evening. Seemingly traveling along 35th Street, a path was traced by the Non-Prelli from the My Car Wash off 35th Street and West Broadway down to the apartment complexes on the end of 35th Street before hitting Interstate 29. Many homes in between these blocks were unscathed, hinting toward the jumps that residents suspected based on the Non-Prelli's observation of damages. The roof of the car wash flew off over several houses before landing on top of a car outside in the middle of the road in front of 3521 Avenue A. My son went out back where I was just kind of hanging out, and the next thing I know I heard him say was, "Mom, get to the effing basement," said Denise Sprinkle, a resident along Avenue A. Sprinkle's home sustained damage to its roof, yet she's already found support in the community. "My husband happens to know a roofer, and he's already coming out," Sprinkle said. "The community and everyone has just been great," said Amy Falconer, who had joined in company with Sprinkle. Power lines adjacent to the homes would be knocked out where the tornado touched down, cutting power to the homes on the block, a Mega Saver gas station, and a Wendy's restaurant. "I was supposed to get off work at 4:30 p.m., but I couldn't get off until 5 p.m., That's probably would have been going right underneath this thing," said neighbor Matt Cross, in reference to the roof in the middle of the road. A lot of people got lucky. This could have been worse, a lot worse. Meteorologists were still sorting through reports of tornadoes in the region, with one believing to have been moved through Crescent and up toward Woodbine. They received about 80 reports of tornadoes. That number, however, includes multiple people reporting the same twister. The final number, ultimately, will be much lower. The Valley Office issued 42 tornado warnings during the storm, and most it has issued in a single day. Daniel Fielenhold, manager of the Pink Poodle Steakhouse in Crescent, said he was outside watching the weather with his daughter and restaurant employees. He said, "It looked like a pretty big tornado was forming northeast of town. It started raining, and then it started hailing, and then all the clouds started to kind of swirl and come together. And as soon as the wind started to pick up, that's when I headed for the basement, but we never saw it," Fienhold said. Another tornado was believed to have started near Manola, in its wake. A resident of Harlan shared photos with the Nonpareil, showing a tornado described as moving parallel to Highway 59. After the severe thunderstorm finished pushing through western Iowa, it crossed paths with the Des Moines metropolitan area. In the community of Pleasant Hill, a suspected tornado damaged nearly 20 homes, injuring one person. Nonpareil managing editor Scott Stewart contributed to this report, which also contains material from the Associated Press and the Omaha World Herald. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. Our next story is titled, "Council Bluffs Police Investigate Deaths of Two Omaha Men," written by Kevin Cole from Omaha World Herald. Council Bluffs Police said that Sunday that officers are investigating after two Omaha men were found dead on the west side of the city. Police and fire department medics were called to the 2100 block of South 29th Street about 12:20 a.m. for a report of a man down. First responders located Denote Ivory, 36, deceased on the roadway just north of the Horseshoe Council Bluffs Casino. Shortly after 7 a.m., police and medics were called to the entrance of Western Trails Historic Center, 3434 Richard Downing Ave, about 2.5 miles south of where Ivory had been found. Someone walking their dog found the body of Michael Anderson, 25, who was pronounced dead at the scene. Autopsies will be performed on both men. Police said detectives are investigating the circumstances of both deaths, including whether they are related. Anyone with information regarding these incidents is urged to contact the Council Bluffs Police Department Criminal Investigation Division at 712-328-4728 or Council Bluffs Crime Stoppers at 712-328-7867. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. Our next story is titled, "Cleanup Underway After Tornado Strike," from the Omaha World Herald. At the start of the article, there is a picture of a man cleaning up debris in the wake of tornadoes. With extra muscle and machinery provided by friends, relatives, and volunteers, those impacted by tornadoes in the metro area Friday began the daunting task of assessing losses, moving tree limbs and debris, and making sense of what happened, and thinking about what will come next. State and local officials stressed that advanced warning from the National Weather Service, coverage by local news media in solid preparation, and quick action by emergency responders, coupled with the fact that residents heeded warnings and took shelter, limited the storm's impact on life and limb. "It's an extraordinary miracle that we had a cell like this come through and no loss of life," Nebraska Governor Jim Pellin said during a briefing Saturday morning after touring the impacted areas. "The tornadoes that struck the area were rare in their ferocity," said Chris Franks, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska, "especially for storms striking a metropolitan area." Franks said five assessment teams are surveying the damage from the storms to determine how strong they were. He said the same cell moving through to Nebraska produced the tornado near Lincoln and Waverly and the one that hit Elkhorn, Bennington, and Blair. "It lasted for more than an hour and is being measured preliminary as an EF3 on the Enhanced Fujita scale, with wind speeds estimated to be between 135 and 165 miles per hour. The second tornado, preliminary measured as an EF2, formed over Epley Airfield. There it destroyed four general aviation hangars and damaged several other buildings and wrecked 31 privately owned aircrafts before moving northeast across the Missouri River into western Iowa. The wind speeds were estimated at 110 to 135 miles per hour. These are strong tornadoes and rare tornadoes," Frank said. "To have these kind of tornadoes that have less than a 10% chance of happening in the metro is extraordinary." Local police and fire chiefs said the disaster response began even as the storm was still rampaging across the county. "Many of us watched this tornado come into the area," said Bennington Fire Chief Dan Mallory. "We came right behind it. He said 35 firefighters responded within 4 minutes after the storm struck Bennington. They found 60 to 65 homes severely damaged, primarily in Newport Landing, Bennington Lakes, and Woodlands Crossing. These aren't events that normally happen in our area, but we have to be prepared for it, Mallory said. Travis Harlow, Waterloo's fire chief, described the tornado as fast, devastating, and very destructive. He said it missed his town, but caused damage in the rural areas from the West Dodge Expressway south to F Street, and between 252nd Street and the Elkhorn River. Omaha firefighters were the first to reach damaged neighborhoods in Elkhorn. Our crews were literally driving into neighborhoods where our neighbors were filing out of their damaged properties, said Omaha Fire Chief Kathy Bossman. Our firefighters reported the shock that they could see on our neighbors' faces. She said fire crews completed their search of damaged homes by 9:30 p.m. and found no dead or seriously injured. Bosman said at least two of her firefighters lost their own homes during the storm. So did two high-level battalion commanders with the Omaha Police Department, said Police Chief Todd Schmander. By Saturday, however, much of the focus in those hard-hit neighborhoods was on cleanup. In the Ramblewood neighborhood, volunteers carried bundles of rakes, shovels, and brooms as mountains were made of debris and shattered trees. Heavy machinery overloaded dump trucks to slowly clear the streets and sidewalks once more. Some houses came through the tragedy nearly unscathed, but not all were so lucky. Mark Wage carried possessions up and down the stairs of his house that had been ripped apart. He's lived there for 27 years and said he will rebuild. It was the first time he's ever seen a storm like this. So now we're just cleaning up so we can move on, he said. The help we're getting feels great. Elkhorn is a great community. The Washington County Emergency Management Agency said Sunday that at least 230 homes were destroyed by Friday's tornado. Washington County Sheriff Mike Robinson said his office had not had any report of trespassers, but extra patrols were deployed to prevent looting. David Roth, CEO of the Omaha Airport Authority, said during Saturday's press conference that Epley Airfield had reopened after its close call with some delays, but the airport will be ready for crowds of visitors arriving next weekend for the Berkshire Hathaway's annual meeting in Omaha. Likewise, Sycamore Farms near Waterloo, home of Junk Stock, is expected to be back in operation in time for the festival's opening dates next weekend, said owner John Alexander. There, too, volunteers, some of whom he doesn't know, arrived to help clear downed trees. Members of the Douglas County West High School baseball team helped out. Workers had begun replacing roofs on the farm's main barn and the family's home. It wasn't the farm's first natural disaster. The 2019 floods left it covered in a layer of sand. We're getting a lot of work done, Alexander said, so we're feeling very good and lucky. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. Our next story is titled Country Music Star Joins Cleanup Effort in Elkhorn, written by Kevin Cole from the Omaha World Herald. In the picture, Zach Bryan is helping with cleanup from tornado debris. Cleanup from Friday's tornadoes that struck continued over the weekend, with affected residents reporting friends, strangers, and even a country singing star stepping in to help. Christy Anderson of the Elkhorn area reported that country star Zach Bryan, in town for concerts Monday and Tuesday at the CHI Health Center, and members of his team joined in the effort. Anderson posted a photo on Instagram of Bryan working alongside her son, Gavin Shahenan, to clean up some of the wreckage of about 150 homes. How cool is it that he would just show up and start working, Anderson said. He was just out there among the people without any fanfare. As a mother of two teenagers, that's the kind of celebrity I want my kids to follow. Shanahan, 17, is a junior at Elkhorn South High School, who already had tickets for Bryan's Monday night show. He and a buddy, Noah McCumber, 18, a senior at Elkhorn South, were among several members of their high school football team who found themselves working side by side with Bryan. Zach's people were saying they didn't want any pictures or anything because he was just there to help, Shanahan said. It was pretty awesome to see that. Bryan posted his own photo of the destruction on Instagram. The 28-year-old from Oklahoma said he had previously lived in Omaha, wanted to do anything he could to help. As an American and someone who lived in Omaha for some pretty formidable years of my life, I want to offer some honest prayers and hopes to the communities affected by the tornadoes that tore through them, Bryan wrote in an Instagram post. The band and I are standing with you guys as we are playing some shows in Omaha. I am so sorry to anyone that is having to deal with picking up the pieces of their homes and their lives. Without taking credit from the thousands of people lending a hand who have roots here, we love you so much and we'll do all we can to help. Anderson, who also attended Bryan's Monday night show, said her home was not damaged by the storm. She's proud of her son and his teammates for showing up and helping those whose homes were wrecked, she said. Gavin and thousands of other people came together to help folks they don't even know, she said. It was so beautiful to see. Beware of tetanus risk. Anyone who incurs a scrape or shallow puncture wound while cleaning up storm debris in the metro area could get a tetanus shot from the Douglas County Health Department. A free tetanus vaccine clinic will be open daily through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Common Ground Community Center, 1701 Veterans Drive in Elkhorn. The department recommends that people involved in cleaning up debris from Friday's storm have a recent tetanus vaccination. The violent storms created high-risk conditions for tetanus, said Dr. Lindsay Hughes, the department's director. Shelter needed if it has been over 5 years since the last tetanus vaccine. People with more serious wounds, such as deep puncture wounds, dirty wounds, or wounds requiring stitches, should seek treatment from a medical provider immediately. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. Our next story is titled, Iowa Attorney General's Office Warns Iowans of Storm Chaser Scams and Price Gouging. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd is warning Iowans of scammers and shady contractors who exploit natural disaster victims. These fraudsters prey on vulnerable Iowans seeking repairs after a natural disaster, draining their bank accounts while failing to deliver, according to a news release. Iowans should be on guard for cleanup, home repair, and construction contractors, including those seeking business door-to-door and asking for advance payment. Storms that tore through Iowa over the weekend destroyed homes and livelihoods, Byrd said in the release. My heart goes out to every Iowan who is hit. This is when we need to lean on each other more than ever, neighbor to neighbor, and keep an eye out for those who seek to take advantage of Iowans' hardships. Iowans are resilient, but they should not need to fight off scammers while rebuilding their lives. Byrd advises doing research before hiring a contractor. Additionally, her office provides these following tips to avoid scams. The first tip is to beware of aggressive sales tactics. Do not feel pressured to immediately make repair choices. Get multiple estimates before agreeing to repairs. The next tip is to check contractor reputation. Before signing a contract or paying any money, check a contractor's reputation through government resources and with trusted family, friends, and neighbors. Resources include the Better Business Bureau Complaint Database. Contact the Iowa Attorney General's Office at consumer@ag.iowa.gov to check complaint history. The next tip is to verify contractor identification. Request a contractor's driver's license and take pictures of their vehicle's license plates. The next tip is to get a written contract. Avoid large upfront payments and never sign a contract that allows the contractor to exclusively decide on final price, scope of work, or materials. The next tip is to work directly with your insurance company. Do not let the contractor negotiate repairs with your insurer or let them act as your adjuster. While contractors can advise you, your insurance company is your primary contact. The next tip is to avoid risky payment methods. Never pay by bank wire transfer, gift card, cryptocurrency, or cash. The next tip is to beware of FEMA scams. Know that FEMA does not charge application fees. If someone wants money to help you qualify for FEMA funds, it is a scam. And the final tip is to know your cancellation rights. In most situations, you have 3 business days to cancel a home repair contract after signing it. Government Kim Reynolds has issued 2 disaster proclamations recently, including for Pottawatomie and Cass counties. These proclamations trigger state regulations prohibiting price gouging in the affected counties during the period of the proclamation and up to an additional 6 months. Price gouging occurs when an Iowan is charged excessive prices for essential goods or services following disaster. Whether a price is excessive is generally based on pre-disaster prices. The law recognizes a reasonable pricing structure for the recovery period that may allow some increase in prices. If you are suspicious of a storm chaser scam or price gouging, call Byrd's office at 888-777-4590 or file a complaint online at iowaattorneygeneral.gov-4-consumers-file-a-consumer-complaint. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. Our next story is titled, Rescue Groups Assist Lost Pets, written by Margie Ducey from the Omaha World Herald. Pam Wise said people were already dropping off pet food and kitty litter at the Nebraska Humane Society Friday night after the storms. A truck sitting outside the facility was filling up Saturday as news to the extent of the tornado damage spread. Wise, CEO of the Omaha-based animal shelter, said staffers would drive it to the hard-hit areas where pet owners may be in need. We had families drop stuff off. A little girl emptied her piggy bank to fund supplies for the disaster, she said. People are just lovely. Animal organizations across the area are stepping up. Veterinary clinics and rescue groups are offering free exams and short-term care. Chicken owners are volunteering to house fowl that no longer have intact coops. Muddy Paws Second Chance Rescue has paired a mother cat who lost her babies with some newborn kittens found in the rubble of a Detroit home in Honey Creek, Iowa. Jeannie Guthiel, who lives near Blair, Nebraska, said Muddy Paws volunteers, as well as friends and family, appeared right after the storm passed to help her and her family corral the many animals they take care of for rescue groups at their property. They lost everything but the house, including husband Troy's workshop. Chickens, ducks, turkeys, geese, alpacas, donkeys, horses, and sheep were running free. They feed around 25 feral cats. They managed to get 16 dogs downstairs before the building started flying, Guthiel said. One injured horse died. Guthiel, who was trying to fix fencing Saturday, said she felt numb. Her boots had vanished and she was in Crocs. We were in the flood 5 years ago in Valley. We bought a house on a hill to be safe, she said. Exactly 5 years and a month, here we are, standing and picking up our lives. Gina Volnick and her family have been asking for help on social media to find their 2-year-old Aussie doodle, Wrigley, and they got good news Saturday afternoon. Muddy Paws found Wrigley and a neighbor's dog in a tree line across the road from their neighborhood, near Blair. Volnick's husband, David, had taken their cats and Wrigley to the basement, but the dog darted up the stairs just as the house exploded in the storm. She said they'd already had scammers calling and saying they had Wrigley. He's the most loving, wonderful dog ever, Volnick said, her voice breaking. It was pretty amazing. The devastation is far-reaching. Lost Pets of Omaha Area is compiling a list of resources on its Facebook page. The group also has experienced volunteers ready to assist pet owners in searches as well as safe traps. A new drone, which was just purchased with donations from its 61,000 followers, was already in use Saturday. People have been posting lost and found pets on the site since the storm hit, with some success stories and reunions already. Reach out to us to post about your pet. If you get sightings, contact us right away, Kathy Eaton said. We'll try to get people out there. Not just pets have been affected by the storm. Laura Stancy at Nebraska Wildlife Rehab said the organization already received several injured birds. She said it's lucky there aren't yet a lot of baby birds in nests. Right now, if they find an injured animal, get it to us as quickly as possible, she said. Anything that looks like it's dragging a wing, is bleeding, or a baby alone out of its nest. Young raccoons and squirrels could be found in damaged trees. Call the Wildlife Center before touching them, and staff can craft a reunification plan, Stancy said. Muddy Paws, Terry Larson, said she'd had a lot of people calling to say they'd like to volunteer or that they have room to board a few pets and even humans. They're opening their houses and hearts for the community, she said. I am proud to be from this area. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. This next story is from the Midlands Humane Society, written by Maria Garcia, titled MHS Now Recruiting Dog Walking Volunteers. The trees and grass are finally a vibrant green, the sun is shining, and the air is warming up. You may be asking, what does this have to do with Midlands Humane Society? Well, to us, these things equate to the most perfect weather to walk the shelter dogs. Currently, MHS has about 30 dogs available for adoption, and this does not include the population of dogs waiting to be claimed by an owner or prepped for adoption. Every day, especially when our kennels are at max capacity, it is a top priority to get the dogs in our care outside for some fresh air, exercise, and socialization. Getting this many dogs outside for walks at minimum twice a day would not be made possible without our compassionate, dedicated volunteers, and we are ready to recruit even more animal lovers to the team. So how do you become a dog walking volunteer? The first step is to attend a volunteer organization at Midlands Humane Society. Currently, there's an orientation scheduled on May 1st, May 18th, and May 29th. You can find more information on available orientation dates and times at the MHS website at midlandshumanesociety.org. Once you have attended orientation and submit a volunteer application, you can schedule your first dog walking training session. The dogs at Midlands Humane Society are identified by color based on the behaviors they have shown in their previous home or the behaviors being shown while in the shelter. While we know this is not an accurate representation of how these dogs will act in an adopted home, we do our best to communicate with both volunteers and staff information about the dogs they will be working with. Volunteers go through dog walking training to work with different behaviors, as well as how to leash the dogs, where to walk the dogs around MHS, cleaning protocols, and much more. Dog walking shifts are 8 to 11 a.m. and 3 to 7 p.m. every day of the week. While waking up early may not be everyone's cup of tea or coffee, MHS is drastically in need of early birds who are willing to get the dogs out of their kennels for a nice morning walk. However, we are currently recruiting for all dog walking shifts and would love to have you join in the fun in the afternoon too. With any questions on volunteering, please contact volunteer and foster care coordinator Lindsay Anderson at landerson@midlandshumanesociety.org or 712-396-2264. Don't forget to purchase your tickets to the 16th annual gala on Friday, May 10th at the Mile America Center in Council Bluffs. This is MHS's biggest event of the year and proceeds benefit the animals that come through our doors in 2024 and beyond. You can purchase tickets online through the MHS website or feel free to stop by in person at 1020 Railroad Ave, Suite A in Council Bluffs. Contact Maria Garcia at mgarcia@midlandshumanesociety.org with any questions. That's the end of that story. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm Renata Walther from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Now it's time to read the obituaries. There is only one obituary today for Nicholas E. Ring, October 4th, 1960, April 27th, 2024. Nicholas E. Ring, age 63, of Minden, Iowa, passed away April 27, 2023, at Nebraska Medicine in Omaha, Nebraska, from injuries suffered in the April 26 tornado in Minden. Nick was born October 4, 1960, in Council Bluffs, to the late Clarence J. Dutch and Mary Helen Matthews Ring. He graduated from Neola, Iowa, Tri-Center High School in 1979. Nick married Valerie Graham on September 16, 1983 in Hanok, Iowa. They were blessed with two sons, Justin and Corey. Nick worked for the City of Council Bluffs from 1988 to 2019 as a heavy equipment operator. In addition to his parents, Nick was preceded in death by his brother, Tim, nicknamed Dinger Ring, father-in-law Wayne Graham, brother-in-law Chuck Minahan, and sister-in-law Becky Ring. Nick is survived by his wife of 40 years, Val Ring of Minden, sons Justin Ring of Minden, Corey Ring of Omaha, grandchildren Emmy, Caden, Chloe, and Carter, sisters Carolyn McDermott of Neola, Sheila Minahan of Minden, brother Myron, nicknamed Tom Ring of Neola, sister-in-law Becky Kirkman of Ellicott City, many nieces and nephews. Visitation with the family, Thursday, 5 to 8 p.m. at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Neola, Mass of Christian Burial. Friday, 10:30 a.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church. Intermittent, is at St. Patrick Cemetery in Neola, with a lunch following at St. Patrick's Parish Hall. The family will direct ceremonial contributions. That is the end of obituaries. Let's move on to the sports section. Our next story is titled Through the Roof. Fidone finishes spring camp with confidence, written by Joe Walker from the Omaha World Herald. Pictured is two football players touching helmets. Lincoln, at the end of last season, Nebraska football coach Matt Rhule threw Thomas Fidone a curveball when he told the tight end that they had a great fall. Rhule wasn't necessarily talking about the Huskers, who finished 5-7 and went a seventh straight season without a bowl appearance. He was talking about him and Fidone, mostly Fidone, who recovered from two ACL tears that hindered his first 2 years with the Huskers before finishing 2023 as their second leading receiver. My point was, Rhule said, coming off two ACLs to get through a spring and a fall camp and a season healthy, that's what he needed. Saturday's spring game proved it. Freshman quarterback Dylan Rayola's first target and completion was to Fidone, who caught a quick-fire pass in the flat and pushed through defenders for a 15-yard gain. Midway through the third quarter, Fidone's initial route was cut short when the pocket collapsed on quarterback Heinrich Harburg. The tight end redirected across the middle, reeled in the catch, broke out of a tackle, and found the end zone from 25 yards out. Having that spring and this spring and last season to get reps has been huge, said Fidone, who ended up with three catches for 45 yards and a score in White's 25-21 win over Red. My confidence and comfortability on the field has gone through the roof. I'm excited. In 2023, Fidone played his first full season since stepping on campus. The only game he played through his first 2 years was at Wisconsin as a freshman. He ended last year with 25 catches for 260 yards and a team-best four touchdowns. Since then, since Rhule's off-guard compliment, Fidone has been getting in the reps that have him more comfortable now than ever. He's been in the weight room, too. There's still work to do despite already being 6'6", 250 pounds, and running 4.5 second 40-yard dash. That's one of the things Rhule loves about Fidone. The tight end wants nothing but to be great. It's the reason he's never happy, Fidone, Rhule said. Wants to be the best tight end in the world, and he spent this offseason chasing that. He's a physical freak, Rhule said Saturday, and he's loyal. Every team in the country is trying to get him to leave and go there, and he's a Nebraska Cornhusker through and through. I love that guy. That isn't anything new. Rhule has said for a couple weeks that some of his players have shown him messages from people at other schools trying to lure them away from NU. Not Fidone, though. None of that stuff, he said, is a factor if you don't let it be, especially to a kid who grew up about an hour away in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He grew up in what he deemed a typical family of Nebraska fans. The playground at recess often included an argument about why Nebraska was better than Iowa. Fedone guessed about a decade of his trick-or-treating days were as Huskers football player. "It's dream come true," Fedone said. "I was saying to the tight ends today, I was sitting on a knee and was like, isn't it crazy we're doing it's here now, but we're doing what I dreamed of doing as a kid. It's crazy. It's a surreal experience." This, catching passes in Memorial Stadium, dressing out in forever his favorite shade of red, playing for the team he has always loved, was what Fedone always saw when he closed his eyes. "He just had to have a true offseason," Wolf said. "Now I think you're really starting to see what he can do." That's the end of this story. Let's move on to the next one. Our next story is from the Associated Press, titled "Cyclones, Wildcats Will Open 2025 Season in Ireland." Iowa State and Kansas State will play their 2025 season opener in Ireland at the Aer Lingus College Football Classic. The Cyclones and Wildcats will close the 2024 regular season in Ames, Iowa on November 24th and meet again on August 23rd, 2025 at Aviva Stadium in Dublin. The fourth annual game in Ireland, announced Wednesday, marks the first time ISU and K-State have met in a season opener and third time they've squared off at a neutral site. They played at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City, Missouri in 2009 and 2010. The opportunity for our student-athletes, coaches, staff, alumni, and fans to visit one of the world's top travel destinations and to showcase our football program and brand on a global stage was one we could not pass up, K-State Athletic Director Gene Taylor said. Iowa State will be playing outside the United States for the first time. Kansas State played Nebraska in Tokyo in 1992. "This is a tremendous opportunity for the Big 12 Conference to play one of its classic rivalries on a global stage while showcasing our university and its football program," ISU coach Matt Campbell said. "We are honored that Aer Lingus selected the Cyclones to participate in this prestigious game, which will afford a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for our student-athletes to experience international travel while also helping to grow the game of college football outside the United States." Florida State and Georgia Tech will play in the 2024 Classic on August 24th. Organized said they expect more than 21,000 U.S. fans to attend. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. Our next story is from Peter Burnett at the Council Bluffs Don Prelli about boys high school soccer, titled "Glenwood's Court Lovato Jr. Commits to Southeast CC." Glenwood's Court Lovato Jr. committed to Southeast Community College on Monday. The Rams senior, son of head coach Court Sr., has tallied 7 goals and 6 assists for the number 3 team in 2A. He totaled 4 goals and 7 assists last season. At 11-1, Glenwood hosts Creighton on Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. before traveling to 3A number 1, Lewis Central, at 6:30 p.m. Thursday. The Southeast Bobcats, located in Beatrice, finished 8-3-4 in 2023 and are 1-0 in the spring season. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. Our next story is from the Sioux City Journal in relation to the NFL draft, titled "Iowa's Dejon Picked by Eagles in Second Round of NFL Draft." One of the most decorated athletes in Northwest Iowa has produced has a home in the National Football League. Odebolt native Cooper Dejon was drafted in the first round of the 2024 NFL Draft on Thursday, being taken by Philadelphia Eagles with the 8th pick in second round. This year's draft is taking place in Detroit through Saturday. The Eagles traded up to acquire the pick. Philadelphia made it to the Super Bowl in 2022 and lost in the wild card round last season after finishing the regular season 11-6. After an illustrious prep career at OABCIG High School, Dejon starred at the University of Iowa, where he was a unanimous All-American defensive back before declaring for the draft following his junior season. With the Hawkeyes, Dejon was a 2-time All-Big Ten selection at cornerback. This past fall, he won the Tatum Woodson Big Ten Defensive Back of the Year and Rogers Dwight Big Ten Return Specialist of the Year. He had 7 career interceptions at Iowa, with 3 returned for touchdowns. All 3 of those came in 2022, which set a school single-season record and tied the most for a career. Dejon, the son of Jason and Katie Dejon, played in 30 career games at Iowa, 23 defensive starts, and made 120 total tackles, 85 solo. As a returner, he returned 31 punt returns in 406 yards, 13.1 yards per return, and a score. However, Dejon was unable to play in the Hawkeyes' final 4 games due to a fractured leg suffered during a mid-November practice. Due to the recovery process, he did not participate in any physical workouts at the NFL draft combine or at the Hawkeyes' pro day in mid-March, though he did attend the combine in Indianapolis. He plays both cornerback and safety. Being able to play multiple different positions, I think that's an advantage coming into this league, to be able to play wherever they put me, DeJuan told ESPN's Jeff Lugwood at the Combine on February 29th. It doesn't matter to me, to be honest, I just want to play ball. DeJuan's NFL.com draft prospect analysis by Lance Searlin describes him as highly competitive defensive back with plus ball skills and noteworthy special teams values. DeJuan was a multi-sport star at OABCIG High School and led the Falcons to back-to-back state championships in football, where they won a title in Class 2A in 2019, then in Class 1A the following season. As a senior, DeJuan was the state's leading passer as he threw for 3,447 yards with a 60% completion rate. He also rushed for over 1,200 and averaged 9.4 yards per carry. As a return man, he averaged 37.8 yards on kickoff returns and 26.2 yards on punt returns. He finished his high school career with over 7,000 career passing yards, more than 2,600 rushing yards, over 130 total tackles with 10 interceptions, 3 returned for TDs, and 147 total touchdowns. He was also a decorated baseball and basketball player, as well as track and field athlete at OABCIG. DeJuan won 3 events at the state track and field meet as senior with an additional runner-up effort. He won the long jump, 100-meter dash, and was part of a championship 4x100 relay. As a prep basketball player, DeJuan was a 3-time all-starter and scored over 1,800 career points, with a total field goal percentage over 50% while at OABCIG, with 657 rebounds and 419 assists. He was also an all-conference baseball player for the Falcons before turning his attention to college football prior to the summer season of his senior season of high school. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. Our next story is from Austin Hanen at the Council Bluffs Nonpareil in relation to arena football, titled Rampage Offense Rages Past Marshall's In-Season Opener. The Iowa Rampage opened the season with a win as their offense ruled the day over the Rapid City Marshals on Saturday evening at Rushmore Plaza Civic Center in Rapid City, South Dakota. The Rampage won 58-28. Jalen Schleler intercepted the ball on the Marshals' first drive, and just 3 plays later, Chris Elmore powered in a run for Iowa's first touchdown of the night. The Rampage defense stood strong to force a long field goal that was missed, and 3 plays later, Rakeem Cato threw a 3-yard pass to Jalen Schleler to make it 12-20 at the end of the first quarter. The Rampage defense forced a turnover on downs and set up the offense in Marshall's territory. The Rampage capitalized on the opportunity as Cato connected with Mac Novak to make it 19-0 after Caleb Shudak PAT. For the 4th straight time, the Rampage defense held the Marshall's scoreless after another turnover on downs, and Cato soon after he threw his 3rd touchdown pass and 2nd to Schiller of the game to make it 26-0. The Marshals made a quarterback change and were able to march for their first touchdown, making it 26-7, but Cato and the offense responded as Cato connected with Schiller for their 3rd touchdown connection of the first half, right against the wall to make it 33-7 at the half. Keeping their foot on the gas, Ryan Martinez capped off another Rampage touchdown drive to make it 39-7. Rapid City returned the kickoff to the end zone to make it 39-14, but the Rampage would stomp out hopes of a comeback within the next 2 possessions. Cato, who finished with 6 touchdown passes, found Martinez to make it 40-14, and after an interception, Cato found Martinez once more and it was 52-20, heading into the final quarter. Rapid City scored early in the 4th quarter and recovered an onside kick to seemingly bring some life to the Marshals, but an interception from Cedric Thomas, who then returned the ball to the Rapid City 20-yard line. The Rampage defense forced 4 total turnovers in the game. Desmond Maxwell would later power in the final Rampage touchdown and help put a bow on the Rampage's season opener. The Rampages will play again 7:05 p.m. Saturday against Southwest Kansas at United Wireless Arena in Dodge City. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to our next one. Our next story is from Noah Trister from the Associated Press, titled Not Enough, Trout Healthy, Producing, But Ohtani-less Angels Still Struggling. Leading off, your guide to the week in Major League Baseball. Mike Trout has been healthy this year and is leading the major leagues in home runs. So far, that hasn't been enough to help the Los Angeles Angels withstand Shohei Ohtani's departure. If it feels as if Trout and the Angels can't catch a break, this is certainly another example. The 3-time MVP finally looks like his old self again, but with Ohtani gone, Los Angeles is 8 games under .500. The 32-year-old Trout has reached the postseason only once, a decade ago. From 2012 to 19, he won those 3 MVPs and finished 2nd in the voting 4 times. He is already in the top 50 all-time baseball references version of wins above replacement. Trout is firmly on a Hall of Fame path, and he has a chance to surpass 400 homers this year, but what he accomplishes in his 30s will go a long way toward determining exactly where he ends up historically. Well, he's already surpassed luminaries like Joe DiMaggio and Ken Griffey Jr. in a career WAR, injuries have robbed Trout of some of his prime. He hasn't played more than 140 games since 2016, and he appeared in only 237 over three seasons from 2021 to 23. Part of the reason the Angels weren't much of a threat, even with Ohtani and Trout both on the team. Trout hasn't missed a game this year, and he leads the majors with 10 homers, although his stat line is still pretty unusual. He's batting just .226 and has more extra base hits, 13, than singles, 11. He has 5 stolen bases, already his most since 2019. His power and availability are good signs, but with Ohtani now playing for the Dodgers and off to a great start with a bat, even a healthy Trout might not be enough to keep the Angels relevant. Signs of improvement. Last year at this time, Oakland was baseball's laughingstock, but although there's still plenty of turmoil surrounding the Athletics' planned move to Sacramento and Las Vegas, their on-field performance hasn't been too bad. This past week, Oakland split 4-game series in New York against the Yankees, then took 2 of 3 at Baltimore, twice overcoming ninth-inning deficits against Craig Kimbrell. The A's have a dominant closer in Mason Miller, who has 25 strikeouts in 12 1/3 innings. He's a player to watch later this season when the trade deadline grows nearer. The Chicago White Sox are at the bottom of the American League at 6-22, but they just swept the 3-game set against Tampa Bay. Chicago has not been able to take advantage of an AL Central that was thought to be fairly weak. The White Sox are 2-15 within their division, which is a big reason everyone else in it is above .500. Comeback of the week. San Diego had a 9-4 lead at Colorado on Thursday in the bottom of the 8th inning. Not safe at Coors Field. With one out, the Rockies had a win probability of 1.1%, according to Baseball Savant. After a double and a walk, Hunter Goodman made it 9-7 with a 3-run homer. After Brenton Doyle's RBI single, Ezequiel Tovar scored on a pass ball to tie it, and with two outs, Elias Diaz delivered a go-ahead double that sent Colorado to a 10-9 win. Line of the week. Boston's Sedan Rafaela went 4-for-4 with a homer, 2 doubles, 7 RBIs, and 3 runs to lift Boston to a 17-0 win over Chicago Cubs on Saturday. That's the end of Major League Baseball. Let's move on to our next section. Our next story is titled Celtics Push Heat to Bring with Dominant Game 4 Win from the Associated Press. Pictured at the start of the article is 3 baseball players mid-game. Miami. Derek White scored a career-high 38 points, Jason Tatum added 20 points and 10 rebounds, and the Boston Celtics beat the Miami Heat 102-88 on Monday night to take a 3-1 lead in their Eastern Conference first-round series. Jaylen Brown scored 17 points, and Drew Holiday had 11 for the top-seeded Celtics, who lost Kristaps Porzingis in the first half to what the team said was a right calf injury. Boston won at Miami for the 6th straight time and improved to 14-3 in their last 17 games on the Heat's home floor. Bam Adebayo finished with 25 points, 17 rebounds, and 5 assists for Miami, which had a sellout crowd including Lionel Messi, but played again without injured starters Jimmy Butler due to a knee injury and Terry Rozier due to a neck injury. The Heat managed only 84 points in Game 3 and struggled again on offense in Game 4. Tyler Harrow scored 19 points and Caleb Martin had 18 for the 8th-seeded Heat. So Celtics can advance to the second round on Wednesday when they host Game 5. The Boston-Miami winner will meet the Cleveland-Orlando winner in the East semifinals. That's the end of that story. Let's move on to the next section titled Around the League. Suns super team left to figure out next step. Phoenix. The Phoenix Suns thought they built a formidable super team during the offseason by adding 3-time All-Star Bradley Beal to form a star-studded trio with Kevin Durant and Devin Booker. It looked great on paper. It netted 0 playoff wins. Now the Suns have to decide whether to blow up the roster or run it back. Booker, who led the Suns to the finals in 2021 before losing to the Bucks, sounded as though he votes for the latter. "It's a tough league," Booker said. "At the end of all this, there's only going to be one winner. Everybody that doesn't win is going to go into somewhat of a panic mode and feel like they have to make changes, do this and do that. But I think over time, experience is the best teacher. The more you can spend time and feel this hurt together, go through it together, the better off you are in the future." Still in the Around the League section, the next section is titled Finch Tears Patellar in Sideline Collision. Phoenix. Minnesota coach Chris Finch has a ruptured patellar tendon in his right knee after a collision with Timberwolves guard Mike Conley in the fourth quarter of the team's playoff win over the Phoenix Sun on Sunday night. Finch was helped off the court and later left the arena on a cart. The Timberwolves confirmed the nature of Finch's injury. Conley was trying to dribble down the sideline when he collided with Sun star Devin Booker and ran into Finch. Conley tried to brace their fall, but Finch grimaced and immediately grabbed his right knee. That's the end of this story. Let's move on to the next one. This next story is in the NHL section, titled Panthers Pull Away, Oust Lightning, by the Associated Press. Sunrise, Florida. Sergei Bobrovsky made 31 saves. Alexander Barkov and Carter Verhaeghe each had 2 goals and an assist, and the Florida Panthers beat the Tampa Bay Lightning 6-1 in Game 5 on Monday night to clinch their first-round series and advance in the NHL playoffs. Nicole McCullough had a goal and an assist. Evan Rodriguez also scored, and Matthew Tkachuk had 2 assists for the Panthers, who won a playoff series against Tampa Bay for the first time in franchise history and clinched a postseason series at home for only the 4th time. Florida bested Boston and Philadelphia on home ice in the first few rounds on the 1996 playoffs, then eliminated Carolina at home in last season's Eastern Conference Finals. Victor Hedman scored for the Lightning, which was eliminated in the first round for the 2nd straight year after reaching the final 3 straight years. Andrei Vasilevsky stopped 33 shots. Barkov gave Florida a 2-0 lead when he pounced on a rebound for a shorthanded goal, his first of the playoffs, at 7:22 on the second period. He added another at 8:54 of the 4-goal third to restore the Panthers' 2-goal cushion after Hedman got the Lightning on the board 59 seconds after Barkov's first score. The Panthers had 22 shots on goal in the second, which is the 2nd most in a single period of a playoff game in franchise history. Verhaeghe's open scoring for the Panthers with a 4-on-4 goal just 45 seconds into the second period. Rodriguez added a score for good measure with less than 6 minutes left to play on a wrist shot that was his first goal of the playoffs. And Verhaeghe scored on an empty netter with just under 4 minutes to play to stretch his franchise record goal total to 20. McCullough added another empty netter nearly 3 minutes later. The next part of this article is titled Western Conference Stars 4, Golden Knights 2. Wyatt Johnson scored his 3rd goal in 2 games, and visiting Dallas beat defending champion Vegas to even their series at 2-2. Evgeny Dodonov, Ty Dellandrea, and Rue Pintz also scored for the Stars, and Jake Oettinger made 33 saves. Michael Amadio and Jack Eichel had goals for Vegas, and Logan Thompson stopped 28 shots. That's the end of this article. Let's move on to the next one. Still in the NHL section, this part is called Around the League. The first article here is titled Haxtell, Kraken's First Coach Fired. Seattle. The Seattle Kraken fired coach Dave Haxtell on Monday after the third-year franchise took a significant step back following a playoff appearance in their 2nd season. Haxtell was a finalist for the Jack Adams Award as Coach of the Year last season, as Seattle finished with 100 points and reached the Western Conference semifinals in its 2nd year. But the Kraken failed to match expectations this season and spent most of the year trying to climb back into the playoffs contention after a terrible start and failed to build on the success of that playoff run. Seattle finished tied for 5th in the Pacific Division after going 34-35-13 with 81 points and was officially eliminated from playoff contention with 2 weeks left in the regular season. Haxtell went 107-112-27 in his 3 seasons in charge of the Kraken. Still in this Around the League section, the next article is titled Jets Nemeskinov Fractures Cheekbone. Denver. Winnipeg forward Vladislav Nemeskinov suffered a fractured cheekbone when a puck hit him on the left side of his face in Game 4 against Colorado, the team said Monday. Jets coach Rick Bonus said that Nemeskinov stayed overnight in Denver and was returning to Winnipeg on Monday. Bonus added there was no orbital damage to Nemeskinov's eye. His availability for Game 5 on Tuesday was uncertain. This next section is the Around the League section for the MLB. The first part of this section is titled Twins Carrera Returns from Illinois. Chicago. The Minnesota Twins reinstated shortstop Carlos Carrera from the 10-day injured list on Monday before beginning a 3-game series against the Chicago White Sox after he missed 16 games with a strained right rib cage muscle. Carrera battled .306 with 2 doubles, 1 home run, 4 RBIs, and 8 walks in 11 games before he was hurt checking his swing during a strikeout on April 12th. Willie Castro played the majority of the games at shortstop in Correa's absence. The 29-year-old Cora didn't need a rehabilitation assignment. The next section in the Around the League for the MLB is titled Report, MLB to Modify Nike Uniforms. Major League Baseball plans to modify its Nike uniforms by the start of the 2025 season following the complaints this spring from players and fans, according to a report from ESPN. The changes will include restoring larger lettering on the nameplates and correcting for mismatched gray tops and bottoms, pants that are sometimes see-through, and fabric that looks different when players sweat. The changes were detailed in a memo distributed to players by the MLB Press Association on Sunday, and will take effect by the beginning of 2025. Our next section in Around the League for the MLB is titled Briefly, The Astros. Houston is promoting first baseman Joey Loperfido from AAA Sugar Land as it tries to solve problems at the position. The team announced Monday that Loperfido will be added to the roster before the start of Tuesday night series against Cleveland. The Royals. Kansas City catcher Salvador Perez was scratched from Monday's lineup against the Blue Jays because of a tight back. The Rays. Tampa Bay reliever Chris Devensky was placed on the 15-day injured list with tendinitis in his right knee. Postponed. Monday's game between Detroit Tigers and St. Louis Cardinals was postponed because of inclement weather. The teams will play a straight doubleheader on Tuesday. Mets. Right-handed Kodai Senga faced hitters Monday for the first time since hurting his shoulder, throwing 21 pitches of live batting practice against minor leaguers at Citi Field. That's it for MLB section. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 30th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Renata Walther from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.